Hey guys, this is Ishai Breslauer and welcome to the CRE Shark Eye Show, where we discuss commercial real estate. On Mondays, we dive deep into an asset class, and on Thursdays, we go into some inspirational stories for the weekend. Can't wait to start. Let's go. Hey guys, before we continue, I would like to introduce you to the 7-Day CRE Challenge, which will introduce you to commercial real estate and will show you that anyone can do this. Also, I have the free cheat sheet for commercial real estate with the 6 best secrets for commercial real estate. You can download it free. Just click below or above, wherever it is, and get it. Let's continue. Hi guys, how are you? Ishai Breslauer, your host of the CRE Shark Eye Show, which focuses on commercial real estate. I hope you guys are doing fantastic. Today we have a friend, Daniel Farber of HLC Equity. And the company is a very, very interesting company with tons of experience in the field. And we want to hear all about it and all of what they do today, because they are involved in a bunch of stuff. Daniel, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. Great to see you.
100%. You know, before we start, let's take the elevator pitch of what do you guys do today, and then we'll dig in.
Sure, 100%. So HLC Equity is a multi-generational real estate investment company. What makes us unique today is that we run our multifamily properties with a hybrid approach between service and conventional apartments, which allows us to drive higher risk-adjusted returns. And also through our platform called HLC Direct, investors, accredited investors, can now invest directly with a multi-generational company investing in institutional quality assets.
Sounds exciting. We'll start digging into it. Don't worry about that. But tell me something. How did it all start? Who started this whole beautiful thing, this whole big business?
So it started with a horse named Charlie. They used to take tobacco up a hill in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. But I won't go into the decades and decades of history. But on the real estate side, there were several different businesses in the family. But on the real estate side, my grandfather Herman Lipsitz started building a portfolio of real estate, and it was primarily focused in retail assets. I mean, there was a point in time when there was a lot of involvement with land. Entitlement matters, rezonings, more in kind of like the more recent history, which is more like the last 30 years, it was more of a focus on neighborhood shopping centers, net lease assets, single tenant type of transactions. And over the last several years, looking into the more recent history, that focus has shifted from the retail sector. While we still do have some sort of a foothold in the retail sector, we're definitely more involved with multifamily today.
Tell me something. When your grandfather started back then with the retail, what was the thought process then to go for, single tenant, all those? Yeah. What do you think? Meaning,
The single tenant happened more when he was around 85 to 90 and he wanted to retire. And so
makes sense.
It's a lot less management intensive, and he still, didn't ever retire. But he couldn't, I guess, fly around on the plane so frequently. So that was really kind of the push towards the single tenant. The shopping centers, the neighborhood shopping centers, which is a very management intensive business. I think the idea back then, which has obviously shifted in a major way, was, the retailers were expanding like crazy. There was this, a drive of consumerism that was, spreading across America, and these companies were doing very well. And so if you could, the overall thesis was, if you could get a neighborhood shopping center, put in some sort of a grocery anchor, and then have a bunch of smaller tenants who paid a larger per square foot rent, then you could generally do really well. And there was a lot of demand for it until it got overbuilt and Amazon came along and ruined the whole thing.
Exactly. But tell me something. You guys still have retail, I'm assuming, meaning you're still handling those.
We still have we still hold a limited portfolio of legacy retail assets, primarily single tenant tenants who we feel will that still provide value, that are still able to you know, their businesses are still viable. They're still essential. We call it necessity-based retail is extremely important. We're not very interested in kind of like luxury retail at this point. We're more interested in, you know, those essential items that people need and want to buy frequently on the spot, even, you know, with Amazon, you know, coming in within 24 hours.
Right. The stuff that people want to get out of the home and get out of the house and go and buy actually stuff, you know, actual products.
Yeah.
Tell me something. At a certain point, the company had shifted. You know what? Beforehand, the company, because I know that you were you had a big part in shifting it from focusing on retail to focusing on multifamily. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about your personal experience coming into, you know, going into an existing big business. Mm-hmm. You know, the kid of the family is coming in, and then he has to like take the lead. How was that?
Yeah. Well, it's always interesting. And, you know, if you've met one family business, you've met one family business, right? Because they're all different. So exactly. You know, it just depends. It depends on the different dynamics. But I mean, I think that, you know, the fundamentals behind it were there. So it makes a lot of sense. You know, this is coming out in 2010, 2011. And so, you know, so it wasn't just Amazon. It was also coming out of a recession. Where's the demand? Renters were becoming a very significant part of the U.S. population. And so you had all these drivers really behind it. And so it wasn't a matter of like, really, should we, but it was more a matter of like, how do you do it and what's the most practical way? And so, you know, that's the shift.
Was it the same team, or you had to like sort of reposition things in within the office and start, like we say, start over?
Yeah. So, well, not start over. I mean, we had management infrastructure, and, you know, thankfully we have people who have been with us for longer than I've been alive. It's not like you just say, okay, guys, we're doing something else. And we, you know, now thank you very much for your, you know, 30, 40 years. But you know, we did at a certain point, once we got more involved, definitely there was a need to bring in other individuals who had more experience in that, you know, specific sector, especially since we are property managers and we're very active. We're fully integrated, everything from the funding to the, you know, salaries and the payroll at the property level. So we definitely, to answer your question, you know, we did not, you know, necessarily need to shift staff, but we definitely brought in new management as we went along and started acquiring more and more properties.
And new blood, of course, very important. Yeah. When you shifted to more multifamily, as you said, we knew that we have to do that. We knew what's going on in the world. We knew the Amazon and the Amazon's types are coming in, and we have to actually do that. What was the thought process of how to do it? Meaning, what did you look at in terms of the strategy? How are we attacking this thing called multifamily?
So initially it went through the form of partnerships, you know, just basically because you can't do it all. And we were very busy doing our own retail, you know, deals, and also managing retail is, you know, managing multifamily is very intensive in one way, and managing retail is very intensive in another way. And I can go into the details of that, which, I found interesting. But the strategy was started out through partnerships. And then eventually, you know, as we saw, you know, and got more experience, it became, you know, it became evident that we needed the in-house capabilities. And so we built out and we decided from day one, we wanted to manage everything. We wanted to know where everything goes, what people, you know, what's going on at the property. And we, to this day, find it much more beneficial to be, you know, that active as opposed to, you know, just kind of, hey, we're real estate people, but other people manage our properties.
Tell me something. You started saying that, and that's very cool. You said that the aspect, and I can talk about it for hours, but I really want to hear from you. You have so much experience. The difference between managing a retail, a shopping center, yeah, and a multifamily set, meaning, let's say, 250 units, 350 units, even more.
Yeah.
Can you talk about it a little bit? It's very
sure.
Cool.
So you have the fundamentals of the economy and so forth, and Amazon and so forth, but forget all of that. At the very simple level, right? I mean, I think that there are interesting retail real estate plays to be made, but at the very simple level, when COVID hit, you know, we had shopping centers, and I'm not going to say which retailers, but we had mom and pop retailers who were doing everything they could to stay current on their rent. And we were working with them and trying to do whatever we could to help them. And they were doing whatever they could to stay current. On the other hand, we had national retailers who are private equity backed. And they came and they said, sorry, guys, we can't pay. And these people were essential. And they were able to stay open throughout the entire pandemic because they were essential. And so they came and they said, you know, sorry, we're just not paying. So why am I telling you that story? Because these people had something like 18,000 square feet, right, in a shopping center. So, you know, if you have a retailer that can't pay to backfill 18,000 square feet in today's economy, you know, it is extremely challenging. And you have to have all the right relationships. Not only that, you have to have not just a good property, you have to have amazing luck in terms of, you know, they didn't just sign a lease down the road or whatever. I mean, there's lots of different dynamics. The flip side, multifamily, thankfully, forget about the pandemic and the fact that, you know, multifamily, at least in our, you know, our, what we do did, you know, has fared very well, thankfully. But if one of our units goes vacant, you know, we have another tenant filling for a couple $100s, right? Not tens of thousands of dollars that they have to fill, but a couple $100s. So it's a much easier business proposition. Obviously there's, you know, hundreds more units to fill, but it's still a much different scenario than managing shopping centers.
That's very cool, especially in this environment. Tell me something, yeah. What class of assets you guys deal with?
On the multifamily side, yeah. our primary focus right now, we prefer to be in B plus to A. I can go into the reasons why, but that's really where our focus is.
So everybody's talking about, of course, you know, the ability that everybody needs a roof over their head. And that's why multifamily makes more sense, most resilient asset class, all these things, we all know about it. But there's a significant, I talk about it a lot, there's a significant difference between the C's. I'm not talking about these or, you know, all those, Section 8 and HUDs and all that stuff. I'm talking about the C's, C plus, you know, those. And when it comes to people who are not able to pay their rent and all those scenarios that we did hear about, especially in the beginning of the pandemic, where people lost their jobs, et cetera, before the government started, you know, with all the stimuluses and all that stuff. And then you have obviously the B's and A's. What did you guys see in terms of your tenants? Or you didn't see anything, you didn't experience anything. How was that?
Yeah, well, I mean, definitely, you know, so a big area that we've become more active in is Dallas. And you know, it definitely impacted, you know, folks across the board. The government coming in to help people helped everyone. It helped the economy, you know, whether it was the right thing to do, fiscally responsible or not, I'm not even getting into. The fact is that people were able to pay their bills. People were able to pay rent. If people are able to pay rent, we're able to pay our lenders. We're able to pay our suppliers. We're able to, you know what I'm saying? So it's all a big chain, right? So it did definitely save everything. And so because of that, there were definitely people who, you know, lost their jobs, went through hardships, harder to pay, but there was also a lot of other charity funding out there and just government, not just necessarily federal government, but also state government, county government fundings that were taking place. So what we did is we immediately started working also with our residents who were, we basically said, if you're having a hard time right now, you're going through something, let us know now. And so when they did that, we were able to try and match them up with government funds from somewhere. And, you know, thankfully, obviously there were, you know, some folks who had challenges, but thankfully, you know, we were able to really get through it and have, you know, keep our occupancy and our collections up, you know, in a significant way because of that.
So that's definitely optimistic. Tell me something. When you come and you want to get into a new market, what is your focus? How would you decide, I want that market versus this market? We know the general things, but, you know, we have primary markets, we have secondary, tertiary. You guys are all over and you have the teams and you have the ability to look at things much, much deeper than I would say the more moms and pops types of, you know, operations.
Yeah.
Can you walk us through of your operation process of deciding a new market to find deals and go to acquisitions, et cetera?
Sure, definitely. I mean, you know, I think that the important thing is to be flexible. So there is no specific criteria that we say, you know, like a market has to hit X amount of growth or else it's not interesting, because, you know, I think when people do that, they sell themselves short. So we have different markets that we run, right? We have urban core markets that we're involved in, like Denver and Dallas, and we've been involved in New York before and markets like that. But we also get involved in what we call, you know, the more emerging markets. Some people refer to them as tertiary and has a bad connotation. We call them emerging. If we see big growth in a market that people haven't heard of, we love it. So, you know, just giving an example of that, I mean, we, you know, like our firm, you asked about history of our firm. I mean, we bought land in Scottsdale, Arizona when people didn't know where Scottsdale, Arizona was. And we bought that land for, you know, $8,000 an acre. Needless to say, we still are holding some of that and we're, you know, selling it for much more than that. So, I think that in terms of the drivers, I think every market has unique drivers, right? So some people will say, oh, it has to have low crime and it has to have a great school district. Those factors are very important, but it's not necessarily always the most important factor. It depends on the dynamic of the market. So, you know, we're doing a deal right now in an emerging area in Oklahoma that's benefiting from all of the DFW, growth. And what we like about that market is not necessarily looking at the school and the crime and so forth, which are things we would look at in other markets, but we're looking at, like, you know, jobs and lack of housing supply. So there's, you know, a large amount of jobs that are being created in the area and there's a lack of housing, and that their main challenge is how do we create more housing quickly? And so for us, that's an opportunity. So, you know, I think that the important thing is to be flexible in the way you look at these things and to really have conviction in terms of, you know, are the overall drivers of this market for this particular market, interesting.
Tell me something. When you guys check a deal, okay, you want to go into the acquisition of that deal. Finally, you like this whole thing. What I'm interested in an operation like that, when you want to maneuver from the acquisition to the management part, can you tell us a little bit about the process, how you finally, I acquired this whole thing. We went through the whole thing, went through the closing, the monies went to the, you know, the seller. Now we have to take over. How is it done in an operation like that? We all know moms and pops. Okay, I'll go in and we do that. But in operation, how does it work really?
Sure. So in our company, we're lucky enough to have a head of operations, David, who, you know, does an amazing job with this. And really the truth of the matter is the takeover process probably takes place before we even have the deal and before we even have the LOI, because already at the stage of acquisitions and underwriting, we're talking about how are we going to take over the property and how are we going to operate it to the best possible way. Right. So, so we're already discussing staffing, suppliers, all of that stuff. That's all part of our acquisition analysis. So that's already in the discussions. And, you know, I guess the bad side of that is, oftentimes we may not get into the deal, and then we spend a bunch of time on it before we didn't get into the deal. But the good side is that when we're under contract and we're doing due diligence, we're already setting up, okay, you know, like how are we running this thing? What is the takeover process? And then, you know, as we get closer and closer to the date, there's just the logistics, right? It's okay, how do we transfer over, you know, the rent roll? What are the prorations? All that type of stuff, which are the technical details that we dealt with. But, you know, in terms of the takeover, it really starts from day one.
That's incredible. And that's a great strategy, by the way.
Yeah.
Let's shift gears a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about the markets. I'm sure you and your guys, everybody around you, you're carefully looking, just like everybody else who is in this business, looking at what's going on. Can you tell us a little bit what your opinion is? Where are we going now? What's going on in the world? And I'm talking specifically in the U.S. Where are we going now?
Yeah, I mean,
nobody knows, but
that's a very easy question.
Yeah,
I, you know, obviously, I have absolutely no idea. I have my thoughts in terms of, you know, what we can expect, but I don't like to play the economist role because economists are usually wrong. I think that our job as investment managers is to you know, recognize what the reality is and then also mitigate for what the possibilities are, right? So there are several possibilities. In our eyes, this could keep this, you know, crazy hot market. I would not be surprised if it could continue going for 5 years. And on the flip side of that, I wouldn't be surprised whatsoever if there was, you know, some sort of a recession next year, right? But I've thought that also since 2016. So like I said, like, you know, so when we make our investments and really I'm interested in knowing, because I'm interested in from the investment standpoint and as investment managers, when we make our investments, I mean, we make our investments saying, you know, like our base case scenario is things will go as they've gone, but not necessarily hotter for sure. You know, and they won't go necessarily, there won't be the same amount of growth, but they could continue, especially if we have a government that's going to continue to put out money. Unfortunately, that obviously devalues the dollar, but it also puts money into the economy, which, you know, at the end of the day, you know, when there's a pandemic is a good thing in the short term, at least. But long term, you know, we have no idea what the repercussions will be. But I do think, but in our analysis, we always factor in, you know, what is this going to look like in a recession? And when everything goes to what we call 2008, how does it look? And so I just think that from, you know, not knowing how this will go, again, I wouldn't be surprised if it continues growing and growth continues. I also won't be surprised if there's a recession tomorrow. But I think that that's the way, from an investment standpoint, you have to look at it. I am concerned about what I see being thrown out kind of from returns perspective, especially in the real estate field, but in other fields as well. Just unrealistic returns, you know, based off of, you know, constant growth, like nothing can go wrong in the world. And also just unrealistic numbers. You know, it concerns me for, you know, just real estate. It concerns me for investor expectations, you know, but it is what it is. I mean, we just continue to try and be disciplined in what we do.
Yeah, but I'll tell you something. There's a huge difference, obviously, between places, right? Between areas, between states and cities, et cetera. And if we're talking, let's talk a little bit about, you know, the New Yorks, the Californias, you know, and then yep. The crazy growth in Florida, and everybody's going to Nashville, and people are going to Colorado in some, you know, in some yep. cases, or yep. In Idaho. You know, you have certain pockets that are crazy growth and certain pockets that are suffering tremendously. And of yep. course, you can blame the pandemic. You can blame certain parts of the economy, policies. You can blame a lot of things.
Yep.
What is your take when you look at numbers and you're talking about the big cities, the urban, you know, the urban areas, et cetera? Are yep. you as a company tend to, let's say, do you guys tend to run away from and to go to the more, I would say, growing areas? Or do you still look at those places and right. say, okay, they might grow, there might be a boost?
Yeah.
What is your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, we've, you know, felt very strongly about the whole Sun Belt growth story for years. I mean, that's it basically, you know, getting into Denver and Dallas and other areas. So I definitely think that regardless of the pandemic, there is this movement, and there has been this movement that, you know, people can work remotely, not just work remotely, but in the sense that, you know, a company can set up an office in Dallas so much easier than it used to be, or in Denver, and then they can offer their folks, you know, a quality of life. And Denver used to be, you know, have also the benefit of being more affordable. Today it's, you know, pretty expensive, but there's other markets that are still, you're able to compete in terms of both salaries and cost of living and all of that stuff, and offer your employees also a great, you know, quality of life while at it. And so we felt that way for a very long time. And I think that the, you know, pandemic, just like so many other things, that accelerated that trend in a major way. So I don't know that the huge acceleration that the pandemic brought is going to continue. You know, I don't know that it's sustainable to continue, but I do think that you know, to continue at such a massive rate, but I do think that's the trend, that it will continue to happen. I think that, you know, New York, I think that it'll come back, and then New York will be, you know, still be New York. If the politicians don't run it into the ground, it will, you know, still be the most vibrant city. But at the same time, I don't know that everybody, you know, is going to feel like they need to be there. I mean, it may be that younger folks go there in order to get, you know, the vibe and the experience. And then once they want to start families and the realities of life set in, like the cost of living and having space, maybe they move out. And California is its own, you know, thing. I mean, I just met somebody yesterday who moved from California because the lockdown was just too much for them. Like they, you know, they just could not take such a crazy lockdown, and they moved to Colorado. They said it's enough. You know, so it's really, that's just one individual, right? But I definitely think that there is that trend that was exacerbated by the pandemic, but it will continue to grow. It was growing before the pandemic. It will continue to grow after the pandemic, probably not at the same rate. But I do think that is where there is a lot of opportunity in all of those growth states that you mentioned. And there are more, like Arizona,
right,
Tennessee. there's more.
It's crazy, right? There are places that it's like, it's a huge, it creates this, you know, paradox between those crazy, how do you say, areas that lockdowns, et cetera, and then you have this crazy growth. But again, certain areas like New York City, we know that rents are now going up, et cetera. We don't know where that is going, but it's definitely right. Something positive for New York City. But at the same time, you have valuations going down, et cetera. I want to talk about something completely different. We know each other for a while, as we call it, and we have the passion for you know, something mutual, and that is called prop tech, property technology. And you are involved in it in a pretty crazy way. And from day one, actually, before, especially in Israel, where everybody was, you know, still thinking about it. Obviously, there were those startups coming up, et cetera. But I would say the trend was not towards it. But, you know, obviously, today, the whole world is going crazy with prop tech, and the money is being poured towards this, you know, asset class. Here's the thing. What got you excited? When did you... Because no one was, when you were excited about this, no one was excited about this. So what got you, a guy who runs a real estate operation, who's busy from day to night, has retail centers, shopping centers, all the way to multifamily, all of a sudden wakes up in the morning and says, oh my, cool technology, let's do that.
Right.
How do you get to that?
Sure. So, you know, I think a little bit of it plays into my own personal background as opposed to the firm background, but I did work in both the field of strategic consulting in the technology space in Israel and prior to getting into real estate. And I have also been involved from an angel investment standpoint in certain technology companies. And so, you know, I think that that kind of gave me some of the background, but then, you know, if you go into like 2010, 2011, where there was just this very clear shift. I mean, just basic stuff, right? Like why is real estate the only industry that you still have to have like original signatures, and why, you know, like you started reading about big data in health and big data in the banking industry and all of this stuff. And how does that apply to real estate? And so it's just these like basic questions. And, you know, there was these groups that started coming up in different places, you know, throughout America, of prop tech events and prop tech networking. And then there were like real prop tech companies that actually were successful, even, you know, going back many, many years ago. And so it always just like was very clear, like maybe it was because you saw how the retail real estate industry was being disrupted by Amazon. And it was very, and you know, you think about the bookstores and how they were disrupted. And then you say like, well, this is, you know, the largest asset class, and it's going to be disrupted some way. So you got to be, you know, on top of it, and not only on top of it, but you got to be, you know, the one that is also helping to drive it, right? So that's kind of like the background of it. And going forward to later years of how kind of like the PropTech 360, our global real estate and technology summit in Israel took place. You know, we would visit these different PropTech events around the world, My wife, who's an urban planner, she went to one in London, and we went there together, and we came back, and we were like, this is crazy. Like, you know, that you have prop tech entrepreneurs, Israeli entrepreneurs. You know, at that time there were some well-known ones. You have Israel is this big technology hub. You know, you have lots of people from Israel that are involved in real estate all over the place, but there's nobody's talking about it in Israel. And I actually remember when I brought it up with people, this is probably in 2017, like most of people in Israel were like, what are you talking about? Like that, you know, nobody could tell you what prop tech meant, very few. And so we just basically started it very organically. We invited some contacts of ours, both people from the real estate field and people from the technology field that we knew that were doing something, you know, kind of combining the two, or that were involved from an investment standpoint, brought them together, had great conversations the first time, you know, and that eventually, you know, there were people who we didn't even market to came from, you know, Singapore and other places in Asia and Europe. And so we just were, you know, and then the next question after that was like, oh, this was great. When's your next one? We were like, we just put some people together, but then, you know, it kind of organically turned into what it became. And through that, we got to know, you know, like a lot of great people, a lot of great entrepreneurs, a lot of great real estate companies. And so that's kind of the background of it.
So here's the big question. When you, I remember when you spoke to me about the first conference that you wanted to make, and that was in Israel, because you saw that there are other conferences all over the world, and you said, we want to bring something here. What was the big difference, if you could like give us like the picture, like the visual, as we call it, you know, from, you know, what was the difference between the first one and the, let's say, the second and the third? Obviously, we know what happened later. The pandemic sort of changed the world for everybody. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the first year where everybody's clueless and don't know anything about PropTech to all of a sudden, boom, everybody knows about PropTech and it's so exciting. Can you tell us a little bit about your feel and how you guys, you and your wife basically, you know, felt about this whole process? That's going to be cool to hear.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I definitely think that, you know, from the first time, it was much more exploratory. Like people came and they were like, you know, I heard about this thing and I think it's really interesting. And you had both like real estate people that said, hold on, something's going on in the industry. What should I know? Then you had like entrepreneurs who were like, you know, either working on a product and they're like, oh, this is amazing because I've been working on something in this space and I want to now develop it. And so I can now speak with other real estate people here, you know, and like we can communicate. And by the way, I think one of the biggest successes from the first one, which we didn't expect, was one of the companies that showcased at our first event, like weeks later, they had a paying client in the US, right? So that was like a big validation that like there's value there and it's bringing value for both the real estate players and for the entrepreneurs. Just a paying customer, you know, like there is nothing, you know, more important for a startup, right? So, so that was like a big, that was a big thing, but it definitely, there was this feeling of exploratory going into the next years. It was much more, you know, like people already knew what it was about. People are and then we started having, you know, like I had contacts of mine from the US come in with delegations and, you know, a friend of mine from Dallas, he brought in a group and the biggest compliment he gave was, you know, like this conference is like, you know, there is not a single person in the room that I don't want to speak with. Right. So like everybody has the experience. You go to a conference, you get in the corner with somebody and you know, it's nice and everything, but it's, you know, you would prefer to, I don't know, be outside talking to a whole bunch of other people. So, you know, like I think that getting that vibe was very good. And I think that it was, you know, just the people who came contributed to that. Like, that's really what made it happen. And, you know, so I think that evolution of the industry also made it happen in terms of people kind of exploring. And then by already the second year being like, oh, let's, you know, like I know what's going on and let's get stuff done. Right. So
I remember, you know what? I remember going to I don't know if it was the first, can't remember which year was that, you know, the MIPIM, one of the first MIPIMs. I went to that, you know, in New York.
Yeah.
I remember going there and there was a crowd. It was definitely full. A lot of people came. But the feel at that conference was, what is it? Let's find out. Let's hear about it. A lot of people knew what they're doing there. A lot of people were just looking. And at that time, I was a spectator. I was looking around, checking out, talking to people. And I remember the crowds. And you had tons and tons of, I would say, big real estate people.
Yeah,
we're just walking around to find out what this is because they didn't want to miss out. Okay.
Yeah.
So that was a crazy opportunity just to tell everybody who's listening. Nobody expected, you know, moguls literally walking in, just walking around, looking at what is it? What is it? With maybe one or two people on their side, just trying to find out. And then the next year we were already involved. And in that conference, it was already a scene. And those guys weren't there anymore. They knew what it is. They sent their people.
So
whoever, that was big.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's very interesting. Tell me something. I want to ask you this. Today, and that's something that we had a conversation a little bit beforehand, maybe you could fill us in. Obviously, you know, pandemic, as we said, changed the world, changed everybody's perspective. You guys are operating from a different place in the world and, you know, everybody's world changed. In terms of PropTech, in terms of real estate operations, I'm assuming you just operate it from wherever you are and just, you know, it's assets. So wherever they are, there, you know, it's, how to say, it's the location doesn't change. The assets location doesn't change. The property's location doesn't change. But when it comes to the technology, you guys from a conference or a Movers Shakers conference guys, you shifted. You shifted to another place. Where are you now?
On the prop tech side, like in terms of prop tech? So we have a couple of things going on in terms of technology. Internally, we've also built some stuff on our own, but more that's more around how do we leverage technology in order to make our operations better, right? So we have a brand now called Layers, which is off, it's a service department. It's a hybrid between service department and conventional apartments. And we're able to run our properties through this streamlined way. And some of our experience from the prop tech and those connections helped us to create partnerships and to create a whole technology stack based off of third-party technologies in order to run our properties and our investments in a smarter way and in a more economically beneficial way. So that's like on an internal real estate operating way of something we've been able to do. Now, in terms of the conference, there were a lot of discussions because all of a sudden we started getting, you know, like all kinds of inquiries, both from investors and also from startups and so forth. At the end of the day, you know, it's important. You can't do everything and it's important to stay in your lane. And we're real estate operators, right? We're investors, operators. And so, you know, we started looking at, you know, people discussed with us creating funds and so forth. And it really didn't make sense for us as real estate operators and managers to do. So, you know, more recently, what we've started to do is we have started to partner with well-known prop tech VCs, and we become LPs in those VCs, and we add strategic value aside from capital. And that allows us also to have our finger on the pulse in terms of what's going on, you know, what the trends are, what different groups are doing, what different startups are doing. Also, obviously, there's the economic benefit. Which, you know, is a main driver and that's really what allows us to, that's kind of the direction that we've taken.
It's very interesting because you know what, because you obviously know that this is such a big thing. Nobody want to miss out on the big technological, you know, revolution that is happening. At the same time, you're saying, we have to stay focused and that's a huge thing. You have an operation, your focus is real estate. How can I stay focused and also get a piece of the action? You have to choose your battles, and that's a big lesson for everybody. Big lesson for everybody wants to eat, you know, the whole cake, as we call it. You gotta know what you're doing, and that's that's a very good lesson. I like that a lot. Tell me something. Now we're gonna wrap it up. I just want to ask you if you could tell everybody where they can find you, what you guys do now in terms of maybe people are seeking investments, maybe people are seeking you know, want to learn from you. How do they follow you? I know you have a great newsletter. I get it and enjoy it.
Sure. Great.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Happy to. No, definitely. So first of all, I encourage anybody who's an accredited investor or looking, trying to become an accredited investor or just, you know, an investor all around, happy to connect. You can go to our website, hlcequity.com. On our platform there, there's HLC Direct. You can sign up. You'll get our newsletters. Even if you're not an accredited investor, you can get our newsletter. And I hope that we're able to provide kind of some unique content in order to that mixes both everything from the real estate, hospitality, and technology side. So hopefully that will, you know, be valuable. So you can get that on our website. And then also from, you know, I frequently get entrepreneurs who reach out, and if I can help, I'm more than happy to help. The best way to do that is probably on my LinkedIn. So if you just look me up on LinkedIn, Daniel N. Farber, and that's it.
And when are we going to see you next? Let's ask this. Meaning I'm going to be probably in New York in the next couple of weeks, but I'm saying, are you like permanent over there in Colorado?
No. Nothing in life is permanent, but no, we're not permanent
I like
here.
That. Yeah.
I mean, we're planning on wrapping up the summer here, and we definitely miss Israel a lot. So,
all right. Yeah. A man who is traveling between countries and states and operate in the U.S. Very interesting. Daniel, thank you so much for being with us. And
thank
everybody.
You. Appreciate it.
100%. Everybody, check out all the links below, above, wherever you're watching to contact HLC Equity. And Daniel Farber. Take care, you guys. I'll see you in the next show. Hey, guys, thanks for joining me in this CRE Shark Eye Show. I hope you enjoyed it. And go subscribe, download, do whatever you guys need to do. And I'll see you in the next episode. Take care of yourselves.